Columbia class from 1932 to 1963, 30 short years. And I am the arrow, the dew that flies suicidal at one with the drive into the red eye, the cauldron of morning. Sylvia Plath's concluding words to her poem, Ariel, which I've just read you a little tiny bit of, we'll go back to it at the end. Her words are, like almost all her work, intensely personal, making her seem ideally suited, of course, to such a course as we are undertaking. In the words of the man and poet who knew her best, and of course, you know, who can resist the combination of Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, both of them deserved each other as far as I'm concerned. Her husband, Ted Hughes, the themes he said she found most engaging, that she found engaging enough to excite her concentration, all turn out to be episodes from her own life. They are all autobiography. Not only that, but she has described these experiences in fiction and verse, and that, of course, is particularly interesting for us, because I'm saying to you, does one get a more intense sense of a life from the verse of Hardy, or from perhaps reading Orlando about Rita Sackville West? Plath herself was well aware of the dangers inherent in what she called the confessional school of poetry, and she's taken to be one of the main proponents of this, which I think she rather objected to. Whilst conceding that her poems come immediately, and I'm quoting, come immediately out of the sensuous and emotional experiences I have, she adds, but I must say, I cannot sympathize with these cries from the heart that are informed by nothing except a needle or a knife or whatever it is. Quite refreshing to find somebody saying that, because of course it can get very painful and almost tedious in the end. I believe, she writes, that one should be able to control and manipulate experiences, even the most terrifying, like madness, being tortured, this kind of experience. And one should be able to manipulate these experiences with an informed and intelligent mind. I think that personal experience shouldn't be a kind of shut box and narcissistic mirror-looking experience. I believe it should be generally relevant to things such as Hiroshima and Dachau and so on. That was to get her into some trouble later on, that attempt to link the monstrosities and the horrors of the 20th century to her own experience. As one of Plath's most astute critics, Janet Malcolm, I don't know whether you know her book, The Silent Woman. It's a biography of Plath. It's terribly interesting because she's indicating that men write about Plath in a completely different way from women. If you happen to think men and women are completely the same and that there's no difference, then don't read Janet Malcolm. But it is done, I think, very well. But most of Plath's biographers have differed in many ways from Plath, from Malcolm herself, and most of them, well, a number of them have been men. They tend to take opposing sides, either with Plath or with Hughes, or with her opposition to her father, for example, which we'll come to. For Plath provokes extreme emotions in her readers, perhaps in reaction to the highly charged feelings of her writing. And our view of her achievements may be obscured or manipulated by the version of her life we read. The American poet James Dickey, for example, is repelled by what he sees as the slickness of her art. The poems for him are, quote, glib. He finds intolerable in either literature or in the word, the slick, knowing patter about suffering and guilt, particularly one's own. His emphatic perspective, Janet Malcolm suggests, is that of a male writer. See where she's coming from. She's American and she's a feminist. More in the mold of Ted Hughes than Plath's partial model in her poetry, another member of the confessional school, Robert Lowell, who influenced her quite strongly. Al Alvarez, on the other hand, who was instrumental after Platt's death in promoting her work and was a good friend of hers, finds her far from glib. She goes to the edge of polite experience and beyond, he argues. And of course, that's a very daring thing to do. Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. To the edge of experience itself. A valuable counterbalance, he believes, to what he calls the gentility and restraint of the main English poetic school of Platt's day. The movement, I don't know whether you know about the 50s movement, but it was a very interesting but very restrained attempt to be precise about your emotions. According to Alvarez, it needed not only great intelligence and insight to handle a material, it also took a kind of bravery. Bearing her soul, of course, is a very brave thing. Poetry of this order is a murderous art. His claim is in its own way just as overstated as Dickey's. Platt's writing is more than simply slick, though slickness is part of it. And the achievement of her final style is not, as Alvarez argues, to make poetry and death inseparable. That would be destructive, and I don't believe that great art is destructive. I think it destroys to rebuild, if anything. Rather, it is that Platt, in her best work, raises moral and artistic issues of more than merely personal significance, as I hope to show, ones which cannot be resolved by critics who want to use her for their own ends. This is particularly true of some feminist critics who try to make a saint of Plath and a demon of her husband, Ted Hughes. I was saying to Medea in the passage, if you've met Ted Hughes, as I had several times in his life, you'd know why they make him a demon. He looks like one. Very, very saturnine. I suppose the main attraction for Plath. Platt's problems and instability started long before she met Hughes, however, possibly at her birth in 1932, when she may have inherited a genetic tendency to depression, and I don't pretend to know about depression, but certainly what I do know is that her own son, recently, 2009, also committed suicide. Whether this is genetic or not is probably beside the point, but it is a possibility. Her problems were certainly exacerbated by the death of her father when she was 8. The father, whom she had really not got to know very well and who stood there, he died, she says, before she stopped thinking he was God. Very interesting point, isn't it, really? My own father died after I had come to terms with him and his absence in my own childhood, because he was at the war. So I do know something of this problem that one has to resolve before death. It cannot be resolved after death, of course, with the person gone. She herself seems to have regarded this as the psychic wound responsible for all her subsequent troubles. Otto Plath, Sylvia's father, was a German-speaking refugee from the Polish town of Grabow. He was an entomologist who became a professor of biology and German at Boston University and wrote a book about bees. We'll come to the bees later on if we've got time. 21 years older than Sylvia's mother and preoccupied with his work, and she makes an interesting play of the fact that he is German-speaking and her mother is possibly of Jewish descent. You'll see that comes into the poem. Preoccupied with his work, he was a remote figure in Sylvia's childhood, whom she struggled to come to terms with all her life. The title poem of her first collection of verse, The Colossus, for instance, is addressed to her father. There is already something rather nightmarish in her description of her attempts to literally reconstruct her father after his death, which perhaps reflects Otto Platt's somewhat bizarre death. He died on the 5th of November 1940, a week and a half after Sylvia's 8th birthday, of complications following gangrene. Apparently, he was so frightened, because a friend had died of lung cancer, he was so frightened he had lung cancer that he didn't go to the doctor. And what could have been so easily curable was, of course, left until his foot became gangrenous and he eventually had it amputated and then died. But I tell you all the these bizarre details, because I think you'll see how she uses this as a kind of device to shock and to make you realise how she feels in her poem. His daughter's sense of being betrayed and abandoned by him, which of course is terribly illogical, but there it is, together with the gruesome details of his death, the gangrenous leg, the amputated foot, his German origins, and his remoteness from her, all find their way into her poetry at various times. In the Colossus, as you know, is an exceptionally large statue. It is his hugeness and her vain attempts to reconstruct him which preoccupy her, with only a passing allusion to his alien German accent, which he'll make much more of later on. Already, her trademark startling imagery is apparent. And this is on your sheet. This is number one. I'm only going to read you the first three verses. I shall never get you put together entirely, pieced, glued, and properly jointed. Mule bray, pig grunt, and bawdy cackles proceed from your great lips. It's worse than the barnyard. Perhaps you consider yourself an oracle, mouthpiece of the dead, or of some god or other. 30 years now have I laboured to dredge the silt from your throat. I am none the wiser. Scaling little ladders with glue pots and pails of Lysol, I crawl like an ant in mourning over the weedy acres of your brow to mend the immense skull plates and clear the bald white tumuli of your eyes. It's almost repellent, but it is repellent, isn't it? But Plath's most memorable poem on her father has to be Daddy, an extreme example of her distinctive confessional mode, and an even more convincing example of the shocking power of her imagery and rhetoric. Here, Daddy, who appears to be both passionately loved and hated at the same time, of course we've all read our Freud, etc., is identified with the Nazis and Dracula, an inhuman creature of one leg, clothed entirely in black. He's a figure which bears little resemblance to her actual father, but vividly mirrors her conflicts, needs, and sense of desertion. And I'd like to start with the first 11 stanzas. I mean, it goes quite quickly. You do not do, this is extract two. You do not do any more black shoe in which I have lived like a foot for 30 years, poor and white, barely daring to breathe or at chew. Daddy, I have had to kill you. You died before I had time, marble heavy, a bag full of God, ghastly statue with one grey toe big as a Briscoe seal, and a head in the freakish Atlantic where it pours bean green over blue in the waters of beautiful Norset. I used to pray to recover you. Ach, du. This is German. Oh, you. In the German tongue, in the Polish town, scraped flat by the roller of wars, wars, wars. But the name of the town is common, my Polack friend says. There are a dozen or two. So I never could tell where you put your foot, your root. I never could talk to you. The tongue stuck in my jaw. It stuck in a barbed wire snare. Ich, 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 ich. I could hardly speak. Ich, of course, being I. I thought every German was you and the language obscene. An engine, chuffing me off like a Jew to Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen. I began to talk like a Jew. I think I may well be a Jew. The snows of the Tyrol, the clear beer of Vienna, are not very pure or true. With my gypsy ancestress and my weird luck and my tarot pack, I may be a bit of a Jew. I have always been scared of you with your Luftwaffe, your gobbledygoo and your neat moustache and your Aryan eye, bright blue. Panzerman. Oh, you, not God, but a swastika, so black no sky could squeak through. Every woman adores a fascist, the boot in the face, the brute heart of a brute like you. You stand at the blackboard, Daddy, in the picture I have of you, a cleft in your chin instead of your foot, but no less a devil for that. No, not any less the black man who bit my pretty red heart in two. As Michael Schmidt, another very good critic of Clapp, argues, here is a poem spoken by a girl, and this is very obvious stuff, with an Electra complex. Her father died while she thought he was God. Her case is complicated by the fact that her father was German and her mother possibly Jewish. In the daughter, the two strains marry and paralyze each other. She has to act out the awful little allegory once more before she is free of it. But it's not a simplistic explanation of the poem. It may help a little to know some of those facts. And like Schmidt, I believe that this is what poems do in Sylvia Plath. Act out the awful little allegory and exorcise rather than confess. I would call her an exorcist, not a confession poet. Plath's reference to the Holocaust and the bombing of Japan were very controversial at the time, shocking many readers, you may even be shocked today, still sometimes offending modern readers. But as Schmidt argues, when she uses Hiroshima and Dachau, it is in part to borrow a horror, to increase the volume of the poem. But it also suggests that suburban pain, the pain of rejection, loss, doubt, fear, misunderstanding, are not unlike the pain of those subjected to the great brutalities of the 20th century. In the last five stanzas of Daddy, Clapp herself links her father's death to her own suicide attempts. She attempted suicide three times in her life, as we shall see. Third time, she achieved her end. And also to her marriage. She appears to imply that she tried to replace her father with another man of the same kind. He's black, too. And she's not using this, of course, in any racist sense. She sees them as something that blocks out the sun. A man who also betrayed and abandoned her. The man in black, she says, with the Mein Kampf look, is both her father and her husband. I was 10, and this is the end of the poem. I was 10 when they buried you. 20, well, she was actually 8. But it's neat because it's her life is cut up into 10-year segments. I was 10 when they buried you. At 20, I tried to die and get back to you. I thought even the bones would do. But they pulled me out of the sack and they stuck me together with glue. And then I knew what to do. I made a mold of you. A man in black with a Mein Kampf look. And a love of the rack and the screw. And I said, I do. So, Daddy, I'm finally through. The black telephone's off at the root. The voices just can't worm through. If I've killed one man, I've killed two. The vampire who said he was you and drank my blood for a year. Ted Hughes, of course. 7 years, if you want to know. Daddy, you can lie back now. There's a stake in your fat black heart, and the villagers never liked you. They are dancing and stamping on you. They always knew it was you. Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through. Most horrific poem in the language, I think. I'm sorry, I hesitated to begin with it, but I didn't quite see how I could get around that. After Plant's father's death, her mother, Aurelia, moved Sylvia and her younger brother, Warren, who was 3 years younger than her, from Winthrop, Massachusetts, to Wellesley. And it seemed to Sylvia, I quote from one of her last prose pieces, that her first 9 years of her life were, as she put it, sealed themselves off like a ship in a bottle. Beautifully, beautiful, inaccessible, obsolete, a fine white flying nip. Unfinished business all her life, of course, but she sees it as being sealed off. Sylvia's mother filled the space left by the father, or tried to, with a perhaps too claustrophobic, too smothering love. Poor woman, what could she do but try to make up the death of the father? And the most reliable account of her daughter's conflicting feelings come from Sylvia herself. In her only completed novel, The Bell Jar, now some of you will have read The Bell Jar, published in January 1963, just before she committed suicide, which describes the events leading up to and including her breakdown. She was 21 when she had her first breakdown, and she was studying at the prestigious ladies' college, Smith College. She'd excelled academically during her first 3 years. She'd written for the magazine. She was doing extremely well. She wrote very proudly to her mother, "The world is splitting open at my feet like a ripe, juicy watermelon." Had a lot of watermelons in this course, haven't we? Sasha and Sylvia Plath were both watermelons. She had been writing all her life. Her first poem accepted for a Boston newspaper at the age of 8 and a half. There must have been some influence at work there. And was now being considered for magazines like Seventeen and Mademoiselle in America, and helped to edit that magazine. So it was not a surprise when she won a coveted position at a magazine in New York for the summer break, and they paid her expenses and put her up in a hotel. And this is the period that occupies quite a section of The Bell Jar and how she finds. It's a wonderful picture of a mind gradually disintegrating and what leads up to that final attempt to bury herself under her own house, having taken all of her mother's sleeping pills, which she'd carefully locked up. The job started, therefore, a downward spiral which led to thoughts of suicide, not improved that same summer by her rejection by a Harvard writing seminar. She was always used to being accepted for everything, and rejection was hard. The Bell Jar is very powerful indeed in its depiction of these events, as she piles image on image. I mean, if you go through any passage, you're bound to find some of these awful images. I'm going to show you something positive in a minute about that, but I do have to go through this first. Worms, black water, a cacophony of voices. Well, you've already had the cacophony of voices, haven't you? Mummy bands, you know, Egyptian mummy bands tying you down. Endless tunnels to convey the extraordinary sensations of someone breaking down completely and wanting to die. Extract 3 on your sheet. It was completely dark. This is the description of her attempt at suicide. It was completely dark. I felt the darkness, but nothing else. And my head rose, feeling it like the head of a worm. Someone was moaning. Then a great and hard weight smashed against my cheek like a stone wall. And the moaning stopped. The silence surged back, smoothing itself as black water smooths to its own surface calm over a drop of stone. A cool wind rushed by. I was being transported at enormous speed down a tunnel into the earth. Then the wind stopped. There was a rumbling as of many voices protesting and disagreeing in the distance. Then the voices stopped. A chisel cracked down on my eye, and a slit of light opened like a mouth or a wound till the darkness clamped shut on it again. I tried to roll away from the direction of the light, but hands wrapped round my limbs like mummy bands, and I couldn't move. I began to think I must be in an underground chamber lit by blinding lights, and that the chamber was full of people who for some reason were holding me down. Then the chisel struck again, and the light leapt into my head, and through the thick, warm, furry dark, a voice cried, "Mother!" Sylvia Plath herself, of course, calling for her mother. Many people read The Bell Jar, which was written at great speed in the last year of Plath's life, and published a month before her death, for its autobiographical content. But it is also a penetrating account of a depression and breakdown, and an indictment of the 50s in America. It shows the kind of glitziness and tawdriness of America. It chronicles the breakdown, suicide attempt, and recovery of its heroine, Esther Greenwood, in Esther's own voice. a voice which Janet Malcolm argues has all the disdain of the speaker of Platt's later poetry, if not its chilly beauty and authority. It has a deceptive accessibility, a bit like a sort of woman's own story, and then I went up to New York and I did this and I did that. But we must not be taken in by this. For as Malcolm puts it, it is a girl's book written by a woman who has been to hell and back and wants to revenge herself on her tormentors. In this case, she regards her tormentor as her mother. It is a girl's book filled with poison, vomit, blood, and bolts of electricity, because she had shock treatment. And the book opens with an image of the Rosenbergs who were electrocuted in America for espionage. And Esther's horrifyingly powerful shock treatment is therefore linked with the electrocution, the death by electrocution of the Rosenbergs. And people by creepy old men, usually psychiatrists, and pathetic older women, Esther's mother chief among them. In a passage which helps to explain the book's enigmatic title, A Bell Jar, and as you may know, I certainly did know but thought I'd better look it up again, is a piece of laboratory equipment used for creating vacuums. And of course, this is exactly what she's experiencing. Platt manages also to convey her protagonist's sense of isolation, even from her mother, her resentment of her, and her powerful sense of being suffocated, trapped in a nightmare world. In the passage, the only other passage I want to read from it, I'm hoping you'll be intrigued and read it yourself. Esther has just been told that she will probably be allowed to leave the mental hospital. Dr. Nolan had said quite bluntly, this is section 4, extract 4, Dr. Nolan had said quite bluntly that a lot of people would treat me gingerly or even avoid me, like a leper with a warning bell. My mother's face floated to mind, a pale, reproachful moon at her last and first visit to the asylum since my 20th birthday. A daughter in an asylum. I had done that to her. Still, she'd obviously decided to forgive me. We'll take up where we left off, Esther, she had said, with her sweet martyr's smile. We'll act as if this were a bad dream. A bad dream. To the person in a bell jar, blank and stopped as a dead baby, the world itself is a bad dream. A bad dream. I remembered everything. I remembered the cadavers and Doreen, and the story of the fig tree, and she goes through all the events that have been crowded into her life that summer. And the £20 I gained on insulin and the rock that bulged between sky and sea like a grey skull. Maybe forgetfulness, like a kind snow, should numb and cover them. But they were part of me. They were my landscape. And of course, it's that landscape that you get in the poetry itself. I think this justifies, that sort of passage justifies the New York Times praise for Platt's sharp and uncanny descriptions. It certainly expands our knowledge of what people are going through when they are undergoing a depression and a suicide attempt. It's not, however, all doom and gloom, as I promised you. There is another side to Sylvia Platt, believe it or not, described with equal vividness and insight in her poetry. That of a woman who admired and observed nature, who fell passionately in love, and who had children. And it's this side which now comes to the fore, because when she went back to Wellesley, she had a very wealthy patron who had sponsored her to pay for her private health treatment. She went back to Wellesley, finished her degree, and got a Fulbright to Cambridge. I think it was Fulbright. Yeah, Fulbright scholarship to Cambridge. And there met Ted Hughes, who had himself just come down from Cambridge. She never finished her second year. They married and set off for America. And finally, they had their own children, two children. She'd been influenced by Lowell, Robert Lowell, the American poet, as I told you why she'd been in America, but she also was influenced by Hughes himself. And her technique changes significantly after their first meeting. A firm believer in the demonic, I told you he was a demon, demonic forms in poetry, a follower of Dionysius rather than Apollo, Hughes encouraged her to give free rein to her own demons. Emily Dickinson, Edna St. Vincent Millay had forged the way, and Platt began to repudiate the language of conventional, perhaps I mean decorous, female verse. It's very tough what she writes. A fierce and daring explicitness enters into it. Take, for example, the title poem of her second poetry collection, Ariel. Oh dear, I promised you something that wasn't doom and gloom. Sort of mixed. Which I quoted from at the beginning. This can be interpreted at a literal level as an account of her early morning ride on her horse, which was called Ariel. But of course, we also have other associations with Ariel. We know that he's the spirit in Shakespeare's play, don't we? Midsummer Night's Dream. Do I mean that?
No.
Tempest, sorry. Somebody will come up and correct me afterwards, I know. But who is also imprisoned, who has a lot of spirit, a lot of freedom, but is also a prisoner on the island. And she's riding her horse at one level in this poem, towards the rising sun. But on another level, it can be seen as a protest against male dominance, like Daddy. The feminists, of course, have had great times with this poem, and they see this poem as a description of woman's plight in the world. As the poem progresses, the narrator begins, in their opinion, a series of transformations out of the repressed female self. First in the poem, she becomes a stallion, a masculine image, the image of her repressor. Then as she picks up speed, she becomes an arrow, and I am the arrow. Stop here. A penetrating force, also valid of course, which alongside her becoming one with the drive suggests she's becoming her rapist, her father. I hate these feminist explanations. They're far too explicit, aren't they? They don't allow enough for what we might want to put into it ourselves. But I'm telling you how she has been taken up and how she has been seen. But we'll read the poem itself, and you probably have your own response to it. I hope you do. An increasing insistence comes into the poem on the personal pronoun I, with a pun on the I, the ocular I, at the end, as though the speaker is attempting to assert her own identity. I think that's probably as far as I would go with the feminist reading. In the act of creation, there are also references to childbirth towards the end of the poem, which is one of the ways in which she feels she is creating. This is excerpt 5. Stasis in darkness. Then the substanceless blue paw of Tor and distances. A Tor is a little God's lioness. And you might like to know that Ariel is lion in Hebrew. God's lioness, how one we grow, pivot of heel and knees. The furrow splits and passes. Sister to the brown arc of the neck I cannot catch. Nigger eye berries cast dark hooks. Black sweet blood mouthfuls, shadows. Something else hauls me through air. Thighs, hair, flakes from my heels. White Godiva, I unpeel. Dead hands, dead stringencies. And now I foam to wheat, a glitter of seas. The child's cry melts in the war. And I am the arrow, the dew that flies suicidal, at one with the drive into the red eye, the cauldron of morning. Afraid you've got to read that about 10 times before it means anything at all. I'm going to trust you. But I promise to read you some happy poems you'll finally get into. They aren't all that common, of course, but the two I like most occur in this next period of her life, when she gives birth to her two children in quick succession, rather as quick as a miscarriage in between can allow, about which, of course, she writes. Her daughter Frieda was born on the 1st of April 1960, a few months after the couple had got back to England and moved into a flat in Primrose Hill in London. And Sylvia's joy at her birth and awe at the advent of a new one is movingly expressed in Morning Song, which is number 6 on your sheets. Obviously addressed to her daughter. Love sets you going like a fat gold watch. The midwife slapped your foot soles, and your bald cry took its place among the elements. Our voices echo, magnifying your arrival, new stature. In a drafty museum, your nakedness shadows our safety. We stand blankly round, blankly as walls. I know more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand. All night, your moth breath flickers among the flat pink roses. I wake to listen. A far sea moves in my ear. One cry, and I stumble from bed, cow heavy and floral in my Victorian nightgown. Your mouth opens, clean as a cat's. The window square whitens and swallows its dull stars. And now you try your handful of notes. The clear vowels rise like balloons. A second poem, You're, is addressed to Frieda in the womb, and as in Morning Song, much of its effect depends on her brilliant, it isn't on your sheets, on her brilliant use of imagery, as she lovingly describes her precious embryo as a clown, a moon, a turnip, a little loaf, which is of course rising, a travelled prawn, and she's so ingenious with her imagery, a bud, a sprat in a pickle jar, a Mexican bean, because it's always jumping around. I'm sure those of you who've had children will know about that rather uncomfortable sensation of being kicked permanently, and a clean slate. Clean slate, of course, because the child has a beginning in life entirely without history. These two poems, I won't read it to you, but because we always have too much. I realise that I should have made my lectures so much shorter. You could have asked me lots of questions. These two poems about babies are among very few which do not become highly allegorical, because although Plath may be writing, as she does in the next poem, about a speck of dust in her eye, she's really writing about her psychic wounds, about her own problems in life, or about her own joys in life, as in the baby. It's particularly true of her nature poems. She wrote many of these, especially after her marriage to Ted Hughes and her move to the English countryside in Devon. Like Hughes, she writes pieces about animals. There's one called Sow, the female pig, Blue Moles, rather intriguing, Frog in Autumn, Sheep in Fog. They're all lovely poems. She also wrote about landscapes and seascapes, Point Shirley, where her grandmother and grandfather had lived, which she knew very well, plants and flowers, and later on, shortly we'll come to one about red flowers, hence. But she's very keen on red because, of course, allegorically it becomes blood that she is always on the point of trying to spill. And she loved trees. There's a wonderful poem called Elm and the Moon and the Yew Tree. All these things she describes with great accuracy and perception, so she is a very close observer of nature. But in virtually every case, these apparent nature studies turn quickly to allegories, the ostensible subject, branching out into wider themes about life and her own problems. The I Mote, for example, which is number 7 on your sheets, opens with a delicately observed account of a field of horses. Note that while a mote is literally a particle of dust, it is also, for those of you who know your Bible well, of course, I can see some people looking knowing already, is a biblical injunction from Matthew 7, verse 5. Thou hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then thou shalt see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. So in other words, don't you start criticizing other people when you yourself have a much larger sin or whatever it is, or fault within you. It is apparently based on a real incident. When Plath herself got dust in her eye, which could not be got rid of, and that comes into the poem itself, but it quickly turns into a larger question of how we survive the loss of innocence. That first clear morning song, that first clear vision. It's a Garden of Eden myth retold. The I Mote. Blameless as daylight, I stood looking at a field of horses, necks bent, manes blowing, tails streaming against the green backdrop of sycamores. Sun was striking, white chapel pinnacles over the roofs, holding the horses, the clouds, the leaves steadily rooted, as though they were all flowing away to the left like reeds in a sea. It's a lovely picture of the field of horses and how the wind is gently moving them. Then comes the mote. And suddenly the poem turns into an allegory about the loss of innocence. As the simple fact of getting a splinter in its eye and its dramatic effect on her vision of things appears to lead to a yearning for a metaphorical return to the first innocent vision of life. When the splinter flew in and stuck my eye, needling it dark, then I was seeing a melding of shapes in a hot rain. Horses walked on the altering green, outlandish as double-humped camels or unicorns grazing at the margins of the bad monochrome feasts of oasis, a better time. Abrading my lid, the small grain burns, red cinder around which I myself, horses, planets, and spires revolve. Neither tears nor the easing flush of eyebarts can unseat the speck. It sticks, and it has stuck a week. I wear the present itch for flesh. Blind to what will be and what was, I dream that I am Oedipus. What I want back is what I was before the bed, before the knife, before the brooch pin and the salve fixed me in this parenthesis. Horses fluent in the wind, a place, a time gone out of mind. If only she could get back before that loss of innocence. Black Rook in Rainy Weather is equally observant of nature and equally allegorical. Its starting point is the sight of a wet black rook arranging and rearranging its feathers in the rain, I'm quoting, and this is on your sheet number 8. But it quickly becomes apparent that the poem is about far more than a rather gloomy view from her window in Devon, of a hunched bird in dismal weather. Though this aspect of things is introduced with the narrator announcing, I do not expect a miracle or an accident to set the site on fire. So it's quite an ordinary sight. It's what most of us in England see most of winter, dismal views from the window. It is quite clear that then that it is precisely what she hopes will happen, that she will have a vision, that something very ordinary, which is what most poets, I think, hope for, will spark off in the mind some knowledge, some insight that they can pass on. The poem then is not just about a black rook in rainy weather. it seems to me, and you may read it differently, that it's about the nature of poetic inspiration, how it comes, how it operates, and what it results in. More of a contemplation of that than a desire to give an accurate description of a black rook in rainy weather. I'll start at the beginning. On the stiff twig up there hunches a wet black rook, arranging and rearranging its feathers in the rain. I do not expect a miracle or an accident to set the sight on fire in my eye, nor seek any more in the desultory weather some design, but let spotted leaves fall as they fall, without ceremony or portent. Although I admit I desire occasionally some back talk from the mute sky, I can't possibly complain. A certain minor light may still leap incandescent out of kitchen table or chair, as if a celestial burning took possession of the most obtuse objects now and then, thus hallowing an interval otherwise inconsequent. By bestowing largesse, honour, one might say love. At any rate, I now walk wary, for it could happen even in this dull, ruinous landscape. Skeptical, yet politic, ignorant of whatever angel may choose to flare suddenly at my elbow, I only know that a rook ordering its black feathers can so shine as to seize my senses, call my eyelids up, and grant a brief respite from fear of total neutrality. With luck, trekking stubborn through this season of fatigue, I shall patch together a content of sorts. Miracles occur, if you care to call those spasmodic tricks of radiance miracles. The wait's begun. The long wait for the angel, for that rare, random descent. Wonderful description of a poet waiting for poetic inspiration, as well as a very lovely description, I think, of Sylvia Plath in her kitchen in the middle of the English countryside. And I do have time to go to one. Because I wanted to certainly deal with one of my favourite poems, but I'm afraid it's a bit grim, but it's all right. We'll survive. I think she's so clever in which she takes the ordinary stuff of life, the flowers on her bedside table when she's in hospital, or the black rook out of the window. There's no tricks in Sylvia Plath. Of course, tricks of language abound, as you probably noticed. Those lines that run one into another, and you never quite know what's coming up. Absolutely appalling to read, I would say. Everything is grist, therefore, to Sylvia Plath's mill. And in Tulips, which is number 9, she uses an operation to remove her appendix, combined with her fascination with flowers, to explore her desire for annihilation. This is 5 stanzas from the end. Perhaps don't look too hard at the sheet. I didn't want any flowers, she says. You know the way people bring one flowers in a hospital? You have to be feeling pretty strong, she says, to have those flowers. I only wanted to lie with my hands turned up and be utterly empty. How free it is, you have no idea how free. The peacefulness is so big, it dazes you, and it asks nothing. A name tag, a few trinkets. It is what the dead close on, finally. I imagine them shutting their mouths on it like a communion tablet. Now, that's one of her comments, that she just wants to lie there and be peacefully. But gradually, we're drawn into the nightmare world of a severely depressed person, where flowers themselves, normally symbols of beauty and comfort, are personified into horrifying creatures of threat. It's another look into a mind, I think, that is breaking down, in the process of breaking down. This was written not too long before she committed suicide. The tulips, now where does this start? Has anybody got the tulips? Are too red in the first place? Yeah, good. The tulips are too red in the first place. They hurt me, even through their gilt paper. I could hear them breathe lightly through their white swaddlings, like an awful baby. Their redness talks to my wound. It corresponds. They are subtle. They seem to float, though they weigh me down, upsetting me with their sudden tongues and their colour. A dozen red lead sinkers round my neck. Nobody watched me before. Now I am watched. The tulips turn to me, and the window behind me, where once a day the light slowly widens and slowly thins, and I see myself, flat, ridiculous, a cut paper shadow between the eye of the sun and the eyes of the tulips, and I have no face. I have wanted to efface myself. The vivid tulips eat my oxygen. Before they came, the air was calm enough, coming and going, breath by breath, without any fuss. Then the tulips filled it up, like a loud noise. Now the air snags and eddies round them, the way a river snags and eddies round a sunken, rust-red engine. They concentrate my attention. It was happy playing and resting without committing itself. The walls also seem to be warming themselves. The tulips should be behind bars like dangerous animals. They are opening like the mouth of some great African cat. And I am aware of my heart. It opens and closes its bowl of red blooms out of sheer love of me. The water I taste is warm and salt, like the sea, and comes from a country far away as health. Extraordinary achievement, isn't it, to turn things of such beauty and comfort into such horror. And you can see, I think, the reflection of an unsound mind, what I would say was unsound. One of Platt's most fascinating explorations of the natural world is her collection of poems about bees. I don't have time to read it, but if you have time, read The Bee Meeting. And you know how people love to write allegories about bees, how the queen bee comes out of her hive, and how the workers are drones, and all the rest of it. And she makes great play of this, of course, and uses it in her own life to show how she has become herself helpless under these smothering veils that they put on to protect her. Based partly on her father's love of beekeeping and on Ted Hughes's. After poems like that, it will not surprise you to learn that Platt's depression had returned with a vengeance by the time it was written. Her marriage was in serious trouble. Hughes was having an affair. Subsequently, the woman he was having an affair with, shortly after Platt committed suicide, also committed suicide. So I call him knowingly. Fascinating. That was the trouble. Many of the poems in Ariel were written in the months which followed his abandonment of her, as she raged and despaired. Despite her two young children, whom she adored, and in one of the coldest winters on record, she tried to kill herself. Now, she survived that. And in one of the most searing poems of her life, and we'll have to finish with this, unfortunately, where she did eventually commit suicide. But we'll end by looking at Lady Lazarus. I have done it again. This is section 11. I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it. A sort of walking miracle. My skin bright as a Nazi lampshade. My right foot a paperweight. My face a featureless, fine Jew linen. Peel off the napkin, oh my enemy. Do I terrify? The nose, the eye pits, the full set of teeth, the sour breath will vanish in a day. Soon the flesh, the grave cave et, will be at home on me. And I, a smiling woman, am only 30. Like the cat, I have 9 times to die. Now, in the second part of the poem, Platt links her own anticipated death with that of the victims of the Nazi gas chambers, and lays the blame firmly once more on her German father. These are the last 7 stanzas. So, Herr Doctor, so her enemy, I am your opus, I am your valuable, the pure gold baby that melts to a shriek. I turn and burn. Do not think I underestimate your great concern. Of course, this is all relating to the way in which the Nazis took the gold fillings and the gold and reduced it by fire to get the gold out of it. Ash, ash, you poke and stir, flesh, bone, there is nothing there. A cake of soap, a wedding ring, a gold filling, her God, her Lucifer, beware, beware. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air. She's extraordinary the way that the tulips are actually given voices and sounds. I mean, it's just amazing the way she combines what one sees with how one says it. Anyway, this is where she committed suicide, and I know you want the gory details. She put her head, well, you probably don't actually, she put her head in a gas oven. She protected the children's room very carefully so that the gas wouldn't get through. And, of course, debate still reigns. If the char lady had come a little bit earlier, would she have lived? I think that, in fact, she'd have been less famous.